First. Welcome everyone to season 3, episode 2 of That's Not What Andrea Told Me. We have a special episode for you today, a limited edition, if you will, in honor of Women's History Month.
Yay.
So you don't know, Andrea is a professor.
I really keep that a secret.
Yeah, we really never even mentioned it. And so she's coincidentally also in politics in women's studies. So we're going to just learn a little bit today. I'll be mostly quiet for the episode. I'll chime in here and there, but over to you.
Okay. Yeah. Do ask questions because, you know, yeah. I'll just say like a smidge of background. When I was in undergrad, I took a class with Professor Gretchen Ritter, Dr. Gretchen Ritter, who taught at UT for quite a while. She went on, I think she became a law school dean. You know, she has worked her way up the administrative ladder of academia. But I took a gender and the law class with her, where I learned all about legal cases impacting women's political status. And that really sparked my interest in this, generally speaking. And then when I was in grad school, I had the opportunity to sit in on a women in politics class that was offered very regularly by an adjunct at UH. It was a very, very popular class. I'm not sure if she still teaches, but a lot of what I learned in terms of teaching about the early stuff, I got from her class. I really, really enjoyed her class. So sitting in, I sat in on it a couple of different times. So then once I got to University of Montevallo, I had a lot of freedom and flexibility to decide what I wanted to teach. They really needed me to teach public policy, but then I had some freedom past that. So since the fall of 2016, I have offered a women in politics, although starting in the fall of 24, it's going to be called gender in politics to be a little bit more inclusive. Yeah, I just actually sat in on a panel at my conference in January to learn a little bit about that, how we can sort of adapt to be more inclusive on our campus. But so since fall of 2016, every even numbered fall, I teach because there's races going on, right? So obviously right now we're in the middle of a presidential race. Of course, in 2 years, it'll be midterms, but it always makes for an interesting conversation because we look at how women run. And that's kind of their big project in that class is looking at how women campaign and run their campaigns and how that differs by party, how that differs by who you're running against, if you're running against another woman or if you're running against a male candidate. So, but what we're going to talk about today are just kind of the foundations for how we got where we are today in terms of women and the political sphere. So I'm going to start with some things that people might not know much about. And that is, so we are the colonies and we are very much under British law in the 1700s and subscribing to the British common law, which is oftentimes judge-made law or just law that sort of kind of, it's not necessarily law passed by a legislative body, but it just kind of builds up over time. And the specific principle that applies to us here is the principle of coverture. Have you learned about coverture before, Case?
Yes, but it has been somewhere in the realm of 16 years ago.
Okay. Do you remember what it is without looking at it?
No, not well enough. I mean, okay. I could cheat because I can see your notes.
Right. But... so in essence, the principle of coverture said that women had no legal status of their own. Any legal standing that they had came from their closest male relative. So that could be a father, a brother, it could be a son in some cases, a cousin, just kind of a husband, obviously, that's kind of the biggest one. And so that was your legal standing was connected to that closest male relative. And so we live under remnants of that even today. But when the US Constitution is ratified in 1789, it's really, really revolutionary at the time, right? So the writings of the founding fathers were truly just considered insane when you think about representative government and the role of the people. So that's not where we had been, right? So right. England in England, they're still subscribing sort of to that divine right of kings, right? That God says the king is the king. And so you don't challenge that, because if you do, you're challenging God.
Right.
So some pretty fundamental issues there. And so thinking about theorists that people might recognize, John Locke, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Thomas Hobbes, these are the theorists that a lot of our founding fathers read, namely Thomas Jefferson. And they have sort of evolving ideas about the relationship of a person to their government, namely that power is invested in the people and we give power to our representatives to, you know, to govern us. So, like I said, very revolutionary at the time. And what's interesting is our initial constitution, right, which is 7 articles, and then the first 10 amendments, which were ratified almost right away, the Bill of Rights, it is completely gender neutral. So any reference to a person, it's person, people, elector, right? There's no specific mention of men or women, but women are excluded sort of naturally because of this principle of coverture, because women have no legal standing. And so just in case it's been a minute since people have read the Constitution, a couple of the phrasing. So like when it's talking about our representative structure, no person shall be a representative who shall not have attained 25 years of age, right? The House of Representatives shall be chosen by people from the states. So it's that kind of language. So then as we move into the 1800s, we start to have movements snowballing, namely the abolition movement and the temperance movement. So largely politics was considered a man's game, right? That it was inappropriate for women to be in that sphere. But women started to gain access to decision-making in some cases, but at least having a political voice, like we might think about it today, as it relates to abolition and then ultimately temperance. And the temperance movement is interesting because it was definitely a strategy to connect drinking to women's home life. Mm-hmm. And that's how we sort of were like, well, we can talk about this in a public space because we're talking about my home. Right. Mm-hmm. And so two names that people may or may not remember, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott, are two pretty well-known abolitionists in the United States. And they travel to London to go to an abolition convention, but they are turned away at the door because they are women and they don't like this. So they come back home, they stay in touch, letter writing. And ultimately, their relationship results in the organization of the Seneca Falls Convention, which happens in Seneca Falls, New York in 1848. Are you familiar with this?
Yes.
Okay. Have you been to Seneca Falls?
No.
Me neither. And I want to go. So we should. It's a national park.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I want to back up for a second.
Okay.
When you were talking about the Constitution being gender neutral.
Mm-hmm.
So in one of the articles then that it specified then that women could not vote?
No. And we're going to talk about that in a minute. So this is what's so interesting is, and we're actually kind of struggling with this today. The US Constitution, especially in the early phases, doesn't address the right to vote. And it certainly doesn't address elections, which is partially why we're arguing today around who gets to set rules around elections. Is it the federal government, state government? And so that gets into a larger conversation of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Okay. But yeah, I'm going to talk about what your question in just a second.
Okay. Yeah. So we're back in Seneca Falls.
Back in Seneca Falls, 1848. And these ladies do something really brilliant, which, because keep in mind, 1848, we've only had the U.S. Constitution at that point for about 50 years. So this whole Revolutionary War, the development of the Constitution, all of this is, you know, people remember these things. It's in recent memory. And so they take the Declaration of Independence and they reword it and call it the Declaration of Sentiments. And it includes men and women. And so I don't have the text here, but I would encourage people to look it up. It's really quite interesting because it truly does just follow the order of the Declaration of Independence, which just including women instead of excluding them. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, what they do, and Casey can see some PowerPoints that I created to present on this a while back. And what you have here is the ad that went out to advertise Seneca Falls. And so the first day, the meeting was only for women, but on the second day, men and women were allowed to attend. And one of the most famous attendees on day two was Frederick Douglass, which people may remember. Yeah. So ultimately, they vote on a whole series of resolutions around equality and talking about it as a violation of human rights. Talking about it a little bit in the context of religion and God, that God intended women to be equal to men, and that in order to be a better citizen, women need to be upheld to the same level as men, right? Like women need to also do their civic duty. So thinking about things like jury service, things like that. Mm-hmm. All of these resolutions pass unanimously among the convention. But the one that was hotly debated and hotly contested is worded like this: resolved that it is the duty of the women of this country to secure to themselves their sacred right to the elective franchise. So this resolution that women should have the right to vote. And the argument against it was not that women shouldn't have the right to vote, but rather if they argue that they should have the right to vote, that nobody will take them seriously. And you see this, there's a lot of really interesting writings that happen around this time from Susan B. Anthony, you know, kind of the big names that we might think about being associated with suffrage, where the people are thinking very heavily and theoretically about roles and how that should manifest ultimately in government. So Seneca Falls happens in 1848. Do you know what big event happens in the United States in 1860?
The Revolutionary War.
Close. Civil War.
So that's what I meant to say.
Yeah, I know it was. Yeah. So Civil War breaks out and women's right to vote and women's rights completely backburnered, right? Mm-hmm. While we're not only fighting the war, but then subsequently rebuilding after the war. So, and as I mentioned, I think a lot of these women were deeply involved in the abolition movement. So they were doing that work as well. Mm-hmm. So when we come out of the Civil War, the first amendment to the Constitution that is made is the 13th Amendment, which abolishes slavery. Mm-hmm. People are probably roughly familiar with that. And so the initial thought process was that abolishing slavery in the Constitution would provide civil rights to newly freed slaves. Okay. But that's not what happened, right? Southern states, former slave states, immediately start passing laws that restrict rights of newly freed slaves. So you could think about these in terms of not being allowed to serve on juries, curfews that, you know, white people were not susceptible to, prohibitions around owning land, various jobs, things like that. So as these problems start to pop up, then Congress passes the 14th Amendment in 1866. Quite a few things happen in the 14th Amendment. Oftentimes today when we talk about it, we're talking about it in terms of birthright citizenship. Mm-hmm. But the reason we're talking about it today is it is the first time that citizens and voters are defined as male. So we actually see the word male in the Constitution in Section 2. And so this is going to become problematic for the question you asked earlier about voting. And so they thought, okay, 14th Amendment, this will give Black men the right to vote. And it doesn't. So then in 1870, 4 years later, the 15th Amendment passes, guaranteeing suffrage to Black men only. And interestingly, and we won't talk too much about this, but this creates a rift in the suffrage movement because there are some women who are like, look, if we're amending the Constitution to expand voting rights, let's just do everybody.
Right.
And Frederick Douglass, who had long been an ally of women's rights and women's suffrage, was like, please just let us have this. And so we see two arms of the suffrage movement that break off, and they don't repair that rift until 1890. So kind of interesting.
Yeah.
So any questions so far where we talk about Supreme Court cases?
I don't think so.
Okay. So let's talk about, this is going to get to the question that you just asked about. So we've got the 14th Amendment, and which has some specificity around citizenship, 15th Amendment granting the right to vote. So 1873, this is 3 years after the passage of the 15th Amendment, a woman named Myra Bradwell went to apply to become a lawyer in the state of Illinois. And this is before you had to go to law school and then pass the bar, you know, like you weren't doing all that stuff necessarily. And so she applies, and she says, I have this right because I'm a U.S. citizen, and citizens have a right to a profession. And we'll talk about where we got that from in just a second. This goes all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the majority opinion said that the 14th Amendment does not include the right to practice a profession. And the state of Illinois was well within their right as a state to deny her the right to practice law. So Supreme Court decisions, for people who don't know, there's a majority opinion, and then there are concurring opinions, which means you agree with the decision, but you have different legal reasoning. And then there are dissenting opinions, right? And so there was a justice on the Supreme Court at the time, Justice Bradley, and he wrote a concurring opinion. And this is an excerpt from that opinion. The natural and proper timidity and delicacy which belongs to the female sex evidently unfits it for many of the occupations of civil life. The paramount destiny and mission of women are to fulfill the noble and benign offices of wife and mother. This is the law of the Creator. So when you hear that, Casey, do you have any issues with that case?
Yes.
Yeah.
For one, we are supposed to have a separation of church and state, right?
Very good. So yes.
So his ruling should have nothing to do with what the Bible tells us women's role is.
Good. Yeah. And that is a big concern for a lot of people, right? Mm-hmm. And we could have a whole other discussion on freedom of religion in the United States pursuant to the First Amendment. There's both the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the Establishment Clause, there are three sort of predominant interpretations of how much separation is actually required. And so there are two of those three are like, yeah, no, this is not, we shouldn't be doing this, right? Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, for a lot of students, when they see this, they are like, that's so not fair. Like,
right.
I can do more than just be a wife and mother, right?
Right.
And that's kind of the whole big overarching point that I make when I'm teaching this is when we think about women's rights movements, overwhelmingly, it's been about at least having a choice, right? Mm-hmm. You don't have to be a wife and mother if you don't want to be, but if you do want to be, that's wonderful. And you should do that, right?
Yeah.
Here's what's interesting about Justice Bradley's concurring opinion. There was a set of cases before the Supreme Court just prior to this, known as the Slaughterhouse cases. Do you remember learning about those?
I don't.
Okay. So basically, it centered around the slaughterhouse industry in New Orleans, Louisiana. Mm-hmm. And what was happening is these slaughterhouses were conducting their business and letting the stuff run off into the river and into drinking supplies. Meat. Which, as you may or may not know, makes people very sick. And so the city said, okay, slaughterhouses, you have to move away from where you're contaminating the river. You got to move your operations. And these groups sued, and they said, this isn't fair. The government can't tell us how and when to practice our employment and to practice our profession. And ultimately, the Supreme Court was like, yeah, it's fine. But Justice Bradley had this vehement dissent where he argued that the right of a citizen of the United States to choose his employment and the conditions of his employment is one of the most valuable rights we possess, and the state cannot infringe upon it.
Oh, interesting.
So the exact opposite of what he argues in Bradwell v. Illinois. So alas, Myra Bradwell is not granted her law license. So then the next big case is in 1875, 2 years later, and this is the case of Minor v. Happersett. And Virginia Minor attempts to register to vote in Missouri. And remember I said, the Constitution's fairly silent on elections and voter registration and things like that. At this point, all we have is the guarantee of Black men to vote in the 15th Amendment. And so she goes to register. They don't let her. It goes all the way up to the Supreme Court. And in the Supreme Court majority opinion, they say that voting is not an inherent right of citizenship. Fascinating, right?
Yeah.
And to add a little bit of insult to injury, they do say, because Virginia Minor's argument was, per the 14th Amendment, I'm a citizen, right? Yeah. Like that, the 14th Amendment says I'm a citizen. I was born here, blah, blah, blah. And the Supreme Court says, absolutely, Virginia, you are a citizen. However, lucky you, women are a special class of non-voting citizens.
Excellent.
Good. Isn't that great?
It is great.
I can't remember if this was the majority opinion or if this was a concurring opinion, but one of the opinions, this is a direct quote, says, "It cannot for a moment be doubted that if it had been intended to make all citizens of the United States voters, the framers of the Constitution would not have left it to implication. So important a change in the condition of citizenship as it actually existed, if intended, would have been expressly declared." So if your founding fathers had wanted you to vote, they would have said you could vote. All right. So in essence, that's, we sort of leave off there in terms of cases. There's of course lots of others, but these are kind of the big ones.
Mm-hmm.
And so I mentioned this rift in the women's suffrage movement after the passage of the 15th Amendment, where you've got two groups competing to get women's suffrage, but they have competing strategies. So one group advocates for a state-by-state approach. Let's not try to get a federal amendment. That's hard to do intentionally. So let's just get enough states to do it that we'll get what we want. Versus the other group was like, no, we will accept nothing other than a federal amendment. This is unfair, unequal, et cetera. And then the other sort of competing issue is around how we get what we want. Mm-hmm. Do we do more radical tactics such as protesting? And there's a lot of famous images. If you go to Google Images, you can see the suffragists protesting outside of the White House, outside of Woodrow Wilson's White House, you know, and then they would get arrested. And then there was a group of them that went on a hunger strike, you know, mm-hmm. So some of these more radical things versus the folks that were just like, pretty please, like, here's why we need the right to vote, you know. But what's also happening around this same time are a lot of really interesting broader reform movements. So temperance, as I mentioned, is ongoing at this time. The Women's Christian Temperance Union has mm-hmm. been founded and is really kind of making waves in that space. But you've also got other progressive movements that are campaigning for benefits to help particularly homeless women and children. There's a move in this time to end child labor, which is fascinating because we're right back there. Alabama is actually considering a bill right now to allow child labor. So pretty interesting. And also to improve working conditions. So remember, this is a time in the late 1800s, early 1900s, where we've got more factories. And so we've got really poor safety conditions. Have you heard of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, factory fire?
No.
Okay. There's a great documentary on HBO about it. In essence, this factory that made shirts. So like, think about Victorian America, where you had like the white blouse that tucked into, like, think about Mary Poppins. Okay.
Yeah.
So there were women and children exclusively who worked in this factory. And in order to increase productivity, they would lock them in. So they had barred and barricaded fire exits, et cetera. A fire breaks out. And I don't remember the exact number of women who died, but it's in the hundreds. And women were just jumping out of the building. So some women, like many were burned to death, but others died because they jumped out of a 6-floor window.
Yeah.
And I also don't remember the youngest child who died, but I want to say she was like 8 years old.
Oh my God.
So, you know, so this kind of stuff is happening. And we're like, hey, let's maybe not be a country that does this.
Right.
But all of these things are really important, as I mentioned earlier, in terms of giving women a space to have a voice, because we still believe at this time that politics is a man's place and a man's world. Right. But women are gaining inroads by speaking about issues of wifehood and motherhood, right? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the entree into the space. After lots of protests, lots of parades, lots of arrests, the 19th Amendment is ultimately ratified in August of 1920. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who we talked about earlier, did not live to see it ratified. Susan B. Anthony did, as did Alice Paul, who was one of the more radical members. And she plays an interesting part that we'll talk more about in just a minute. But the amendment is ratified. So do you happen to remember how we ratify amendments to the Constitution?
Just a majority vote?
It's actually harder than that. Oh, so okay. you need two-thirds of the House and the Senate. Mm-hmm. You need both of them to pass the wording of the amendment. Then it has to go to the states, and you need 3/4 of the states.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So you need 3/4 of the states to ratify it, typically in a state convention. We call it a state ratifying convention. So 2/3 and 3/4, that's a lot, right? Can you imagine us doing anything like that today? No. It would be impossible, right? And so pretty big feat. And on election day in 1920, more than 8 million women voted for the first time. Isn't that exciting?
It is exciting.
But what's interesting is if you go back to Seneca Falls, these reformers, these women involved in what we call first wave feminism, truly believed that the right to vote would lead to sweeping changes in terms of equality, in terms of civic duty, you know, being allowed to serve on a jury, being allowed to practice whatever profession you wanted. And that does not happen. So that actually ends up not happening until much more recent than you might imagine. So I think we can stop there, because that's sort of 1920 is the end of first wave feminism. Mm-hmm. And what happens after the passage of the 19th Amendment is these activists, these women, all go on to other pursuits. Mm-hmm. Some of them start to tackle an equal rights amendment, which we can talk about at a later date. Alice Paul, that I just mentioned, was critical to this. But you also had women sort of continuing the progressive reforms around workplace conditions, sexual harassment, ultimately equal pay, which becomes a big thing in the 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. So women kind of go from having this unifying goal of let's get the right to vote to I want to focus on A, I want to focus on B, I want to focus on C, which is largely pointed to a reason as why things didn't happen quickly thereafter.
Yeah.
So that's a little bit of the history.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Now, since you and I both do love documentaries, we watched a documentary in 2020. It's like things were coming out to celebrate women 100 years of having the right to vote. And one of them talked about one of the challenges was the concern of what the impact would be on who would win elections.
Right.
You know, so women voting for who their husbands didn't want to win.
Yeah.
Or their employers or whatever. And the implicit change to status quo when you give someone the right to vote when they don't agree with you.
Right. it was interesting, right? Because people did think initially that women would vote as a bloc. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the concerns, particularly among the men fighting against this, right? It was like, we can't let half of the population all go vote together. But you would think those men would realize men don't vote as a bloc. Why would women vote as a bloc? So... yeah, but it's really, really interesting. And I'll tell you another fun thing that if people are interested is to look up cartoons of the time.
So cartoons in the 1800s, early 1900s, where it basically, they portray men in feminine roles. So like Ralph wants to provide for his family, but his wife won't let him. And it'll be like a guy with kids hanging off of him. And he's like trying, he's like holding a laundry basket and things like that. And so very much portraying giving women the right to vote as demasculate. What is the word?
Emasculate.
Thank you. So yeah. So portraying giving women political power as being emasculating to men. Mm-hmm. Are you looking them up?
I know what you're talking about. What I was looking up was when British women got the right to vote, because there were a lot of parallels at the time. Also,
absolutely.
Right?
Yes, absolutely. So did you find the year?
The internet is hard. Okay.
It's true. This is why you maybe shouldn't vote, Casey.
It's so true. Equal Franchise Act of 1928.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah. And, you know, I will honestly say I know a few of the big names in the British suffrage movement. Emmeline Pankhurst is a name that comes to mind. Yeah. But I know a lot less about their movement than I do ours. But I will say this. Do you know the difference between a suffragist and a suffragette?
One is married and one's not?
Good guess. No. So in England, women were being called suffragettes as a diminutive.
Okay.
Right. So like taking it less seriously.
Yeah. Little woman voter.
Yeah, exactly. And so for a while it was considered like a derogatory term, but the women embraced it. Yeah. And so if I'm remembering correctly, when you're talking about the American suffrage movement, you're talking about suffragists.
Okay.
And when you're talking about the British movement, you talk about suffragettes, but it might be the reverse. Cause as soon as I said that, I second guessed myself.
I would try and figure it out for you, but I've displayed my inability to use Google. That is very interesting.
Yeah. Reclaiming that narrative. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting to think about. And one of the things I enjoy talking to students about is thinking about what it means to be a citizen and the ways in which the government, particularly the court system, has legitimized that right or privilege, right? Which is also a debate. Well, I hope you learned something here today.
I did. This says all suffragettes are suffragists, but by no means were all suffragists suffragettes.
Yes, I think that is correct.
But then there's too many words for me to quickly parse out what the difference was. A suffragist is a persuader. A suffragette is a soldier. So it was one quote.
Oh, interesting.
I think by Emmeline Pankhurst.
Okay.
Also.
Yeah.
So we'll look into that a little bit more.
Yeah. Sorry, I can't remember. If this was fall of 24, I would have just refreshed my memory I would been able to.
Yeah. Which of our ancestors was the suffragist?
I'm so glad you asked that, Casey. So, yeah, because I was going to mention it because she was also huge in the temperance movement.
Yes.
So our dad is Keith. Yes. His mother is Audrey.
Correct.
Audrey's mother is Esther.
Yes.
Esther's mother is Oriana.
Yes, I'm pretty sure.
Oriana's sister is Mariana.
Okay.
Nope. Oriana's mother is Mariana.
Okay.
So Mariana Folsom married a man named Alan Folsom. So she was not Folsom at the time. And they were really active in the Unitarian Universalist Church, which is still considered a pretty like liberal church. And they were really active and they met at a school that was Unitarian Universalist or Universalist Unitarian. And then ultimately she got sent to Texas by the powers that be, Lucy Stone and the big names. She got sent down to Texas to do the hard work And she did. She also died prior to the passage of the 19th Amendment. So, but yeah, she did a lot of work, and her papers are housed in the Texas State Archives. And Grammy and I went about 10 years ago and sifted through a lot of them, and it's super cool.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah.
We should find some pictures of those.
Yes, I've got a bunch on my phone. I'll make sure you have it. Yeah. Well, I enjoy teaching you.
Yeah, that's fun. A little bit of a different take. So what we'll do is we'll have this episode. We will have a 3 on 3s coming out, and then we'll wrap up with second wave feminism a little bit after the end of Women's History Month. But we hope you enjoyed this, even if you are not one of the 75% of our listenership that is female.
I think they will. I think our dad will enjoy it very much.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I'm happy to celebrate Women's History Month with you a little bit.
You too.
All right. Love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye.